to have our dear brother Parkinson speak to us, and the lessons that he's taught us in the past have been valued, and we've fed on them for many, many days and weeks and months afterwards. And Brother Parkinson, who comes from San Gabriel Valley, California, has another treat for us in store. He's entitled his thoughts, Consequences of the Gospel Age Harvest. Consequences of the Gospel Age Harvest. Brother Jim.
It'll be good only if the thoughts are remembered and put into practice and the speaker is forgotten. Now, as there were advantages and problems in other periods of the church, so what are the opportunities and pitfalls of living in the harvest of the Gospel Age? I'll make a brief mention here of Joshua chapter 6. You'll recall that Joshua took the army around Jericho 7 days, once each day, except on the last day. And on the last day, it went around 7 times. And somebody went around with Joshua and the army. They were the priests. Can you guess how many of them there were? Good. And each priest was given a trumpet. That's how many trumpets? You're guessing real good today. Now, I've just tried to outline up there on the screen that there were 7 days of Jericho, Jericho's 7 last days. And on the 7th day, the last day, there were 7 trips around the city there. Now, briefly, the 7 trumpets that were around Jericho start when the first day begins. Joshua rose early on the first day. It is showing us that, what's the Greek form of the name Joshua? Jesus, that's right. Joshua is a symbol of Jesus. And Joshua rose early on the first day. So, Jesus' resurrection begins the gospel age of the church. And then we go down 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th day. And then on the 7th day, first thing, and they rose early on the 7th day. And there we have the resurrection of the sleeping saints at the beginning of the 7th day, the last day. We've got lots of last day prophecies, don't we? So with that for background, Matthew chapter 13 gives us the parable of the wheat and the tares. And we'll read verses 30 and then 38 through 40. Let both grow together until the harvest. And in the time of the harvest, I will say to the reapers, gather up first the tares and bind them in bundles to burn them. Now, it doesn't say burn them. It says bind them in bundles to burn them. But gather the wheat into my barn. And the interpretation, he that soweth the good seed is the Son of Man. And the field is the world, and the good seed are the sons of the kingdom, and the tares are the sons of the evil one. Like the firstborn of Egypt, the heirs of Satan's kingdom. And the enemy that sowed them is the devil, and the harvest is a consummation of an age. And the reapers are angels, or messengers. And therefore the tares are gathered up and burned with fire, so shall it be in the consummation of the age. Now that literal word is not just end, but consummation. And a consummation suggests some good comes out of the harvest. And there are 2 things that come to our mind that are good things that come out of the harvest, a consummation. First is the completion of the church, and second is the restoration of Israel. The completion of spiritual Israel and the restoration of fleshly Israel. Now, what are we supposed to do about being in the 7th period of the church, in the last day? We see this in Revelation chapter 18, verses 1 through 5. After these things, I saw another angel coming down out of heaven, having great authority, and the earth was lightened with his glory. And he cried with a strong voice, saying, Fallen, fallen is Babylon the great, and has become a habitation of demons, and a hold of every unclean spirit, and a hold of every unclean and hateful bird. For by the wrath of her fornication all the nations have stumbled, and the kings of the earth committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth waxed rich by the power of her wantonness. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come forth, my people, out of her, that ye have no fellowship with her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Now we'll consider Jericho's last days again, the seven last days. The priests with the seven trumpets. Seven times, 7 days they went around Jericho. And you know, that gives us our setting for the seven trumpets of Revelation. Just as the picture of 7 days at Jericho with its seven trumpets span the Gospel Age, so also the seven trumpets of Revelation span the Gospel Age, the seven messengers with the seven trumpets. Ah, but we have also the seven messengers to the seven churches, or seven periods of the church. That tells us that the seven letters to the seven churches back in Revelation chapters 2 and 3 also span the Gospel Age. It gives us our framework to understand that. But then we have seven times on the last day. That gives us our framework to understand the seven last plagues, that they span the last day, the harvest period. Why did the Lord not ring down the curtain in World War I? He certainly could have. Well, problem there is there's only one or two plagues have been poured out by that time. We had more works to do. If we look at the seven plagues in Exodus, it shows for us the major world events. If we look at the seven plagues in Revelation, it tells us the effect those major world events are to have on Babylon. And we've gone through things like we had 40 years until we got to World War I. Then World War I, we had the Depression. World War II, the East versus West struggle. And I will suggest that the next thing that we look forward to is shown by a plague of darkness in Egypt for 3 days. But in Revelation, it's the drying up of the river Euphrates. We have seen the East versus West struggle in the world. The East wind brought locusts into all the borders of Egypt, as the communist East did bring problems into all of the West. And then the mighty west wind prevailed to drive all of the locusts out again, so there remained not so much as one locust in all the borders of Egypt. And we've been watching more recently the prevailing of the western powers. But that will come to an end too. Are we finished with that plague yet? Has the mighty west wind stopped blowing? I don't know, but I'll be watching to see. And the next plague, darkness, nobody could move, the river Euphrates dried up. The Euphrates was the river that flowed through Babylon, which it needed for its merchant trade and wealth. That would suggest perhaps our next major world event will be a Great Depression. As one Treasury Secretary put it, a depression to curl your hair, which for some of us might be a little difficult, but nevertheless. There's only one left plague after that, and that is the destruction of the firstborn of Egypt, or the destruction of the heirs of this present evil world. At the same time, the deliverance of the firstborn of Israel, or the deliverance of the church of the firstborn, which ultimately, of course, will lead to the blessing of all the families of the earth, even all those who need to be brought back. Now, the consequence of beginning the harvest, you've got the angel coming down out of heaven. Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, that ye have no fellowship with her sins. That should be our heart motivation, that we not be in heart sympathy with the sins of Babylon, and that ye receive not of her plagues. Well, if you are in Goshen, where the Lord's people dwelt, for the last seven plagues only, the plagues fell only upon the Egyptians. So this is an application that we are to come out of Babylon, not only physically, but also in heart. We could go into that more in another time. Now, one of the consequences of the harvest, at the beginning of the age, the majority were new wineskins, that is, youth. At the harvest, the population of the faithful becomes progressively fewer and consequently much older. The consequence? There is no less desire to honor the Lord before all men, no less desire to change our Christian characters, but there is less vitality to do something about it. Now, we'll also note that the plagues are threatened at the beginning of the harvests, so we should be able to get lessons from the plagues. Otherwise, somebody who was around at the beginning of the harvest and threatened with a harvest, how old would he be today? I don't think so. I don't think he could still be here. He'd be over 120 years old, wouldn't he? But we've gone on to say that the suggestion is that we are in the neighborhood of the ending of the fifth of the seven last plagues. And we do expect that the next plague, we will see, may be a great worldwide depression. And this, of course, would have more influence on the West, because Russia has learned how to live without an economy. What's the practical application for us if our next plague is to be a Great Depression? And our advice would be in Romans, I think it's 13:8, where it says, owe no man anything but love. If a depression comes, if the world owes us, that's okay. But if we owe the world, how does that reflect upon our Lord? So I think the best advice is get out of debt and stay out of debt. Now, we go back to the letter to Laodicea, the letter to the last period of the church. Revelation chapter 3, verses 14 to 22. And to the angel of the church of Laodicea write, these things saith the Amen, the faithful and true witness, the beginning of the creation of God. Are there people who deny that Jesus is the beginning of the creation of God? And what do they say about us? And are there others who claim they are the witnesses? And what do they say about us? Jesus reassures us. He knows long before that there will be these pitfalls for us. So he identifies himself as both the faithful and true witness and the beginning of the creation of God. Now he says, I know thy works, that thou art neither cold nor hot. I would thou wert cold or hot. Because thou art lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will spew thee out of my mouth. Might just interrupt here for a moment. If it's cold, we may like to drink it. If it's hot, we may like to drink it. If we want something refreshing, we drink something cold. If we want some healing, we drink a hot tea. But who likes to drink something that's just lukewarm, room temperature? Because thou art neither hot nor cold, I will spew thee out of my mouth. That's being said to you and to me. Because thou sayest, I am rich, and have gotten riches, and have need of nothing, and knowest not that thou art the wretched one, and miserable, and poor, and blind, and naked. I counsel thee to buy of me gold refined by fire, that thou mayest become rich, and white garments, that thou mayest clothe thyself, and that the shame of thy nakedness be not made manifest, and eye salve to anoint thine eyes, that thou mayest see. As many as I love, I reprove and chasten. How well do we do about accepting reproof and chastening? Be zealous, therefore, and repent. Behold, I am coming? No. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. I'm here. If any man hear my voice and open the door, I will come in to him, and I will sup with him, and he with me. He that overcometh, I will give to him to sit down with me in my throne, as I also overcame and am sat down with my Father in his throne. Now, I'm not going to try to reign here and now. I don't do a good job of it. I don't even do a good job of reigning over myself. But the promise is, if you and I are faithful, he that overcometh, overcoming is our job even today. He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches. Is this a message for everybody else? Who has an ear to hear? This message, brethren, is for you and for me, for each of us, that we may hear it and be zealous and repent. Now, Gesundheit, there's another thing that we consider at the time of the harvest, and that is, in this world, there's less and less security. People are worried about more and more nasty people out there. And there is a temptation, as we feel insecure, to try to figure out, what am I going to do about it? The temptation is to try to overcome insecurity by making all the decisions. I not only want to make my own decisions, I want to make everybody else's too. I try to overcome my insecurity by being in control, by being in the driver's seat. But immediately, there is a fallacy evident in that. First of all, that's the way Satan works. Second is, if I have faith in myself to make the decisions, then my faith is not in God. Now, clearly, too, you can't have two people in the same ecclesia who each insist on making all the decisions. If you're going to have more chiefs, you're going to have more ecclesias. Now, the person himself cannot admit to himself that he is driven by his insecurity, because that way he would have to admit that self is not in charge. Instead, the poor fellow, we can feel sorry for him, whoever he is, but fear and dread take over if he ever allows anybody else to make a decision. Now, perfect love casts out fear, because fear has torment, and the feelings of insecurity lead to that kind of a torment. There are many more people who are motivated by fear than are motivated by love. But the Lord can use those who are motivated by love, not by fear. The choice is yours and mine. Now then, what are the intellectual and practical requirements to be a Christian? I'll suggest that 1 John gives the intellectual requirements. Who is the liar but he that denieth that Jesus is the Christ? This is the Antichrist, even he that denieth the Father and the Son. Who does that? Who denies that Jesus is the Christ, the Anointed, the Messiah? 1 John 4, verses 2 and 3. Hereby know ye the Spirit of God. Every spirit that confesseth that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh is of God. Do each of us confess that Jesus is come in the flesh? Says then he's of God. And every spirit that confesseth not that Jesus is not of God. And this is the spirit of the Antichrist, whereof ye have heard that it cometh, and now is in the world already. And lastly, 1 John 4:15. Whosoever shall confess that Jesus is the Son of God, God abideth in him, and he in God. Now, each of us, do we confess that Jesus is the Son of God? And yet there are people who will insist, whosoever shall confess that Jesus is God, God abides in him. John could have certainly said that if that is what he meant. But he says, Jesus is the Son of God. Therefore, the burden of proof that any such requirement exists in the Bible, that Jesus is God, falls on the person who says that one must believe that Jesus is God and not the Son of God. Sometimes that diffuses an argument that people try to bring against us. But more important, most of the requirements given in the Scriptures to be a Christian are not the intellectual requirements. They are the practical requirements, as exemplified in John 13, verses 34 and 5. A new commandment I give unto you, that ye love one another, even as I have loved you, that ye also love one another. How will you know a Christian? By this shall all men know that ye are my disciples, if ye have love to one another. Now, does that mean, say, brother, I love you, sister, I love you? Oh, of course, the brother's got to be kind of careful when they say that to the sisters, but you get the idea. Now, by this shall all men know that ye are my disciples. Not just if ye love one another, but if ye have love to one another, because love is as love does. So let us put belief into action. Now, the thought of the practical requirements, those are the dominant requirements in the Scriptures, brings us back to the Sermon on the Mount. We'll take just a little bit of time on that, because we have just a little bit of time left. And I think we'll skip over the Beatitudes. They are most valuable, to be sure. But I think I have heard more talks lately referring to the Beatitudes than of some that follow. So let's go to verses 21 through 26. Ye have heard that it was said to them of old time, thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. And whosoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of the Gehenna of fire. If therefore thou art offering thy gift at the altar, and there rememberest that thy brother hath aught against thee, leave there thy gift before the altar, and go thy way. First be reconciled to thy brother, and then come and offer thy gift. Agree with thine adversary quickly, whilst thou art in the way with him, lest happily the adversary deliver thee to the judge, and the judge deliver thee to the officer, and thou be cast into prison. Verily I say unto thee, thou shalt by no means come out thence till thou hast paid the last farthing. Now, I can't speak for others, but if somebody says to me, Raca, I wonder if it's because I don't understand Spanish that well. So I'll try to give more of a feeling to what these three steps are. The first one, whosoever is angry with his brother shall be in danger of what? The judgment. Okay. Yes, brother, I'm angry with you. In fact, I'm not just angry, I'm furious with you. Now we come to the next step, which is to say raka. It's not a word that we have in English, but the equivalent would be to say, oh, you moron, you stupid idiot, how could you do such a dumb thing? And that's step two. And then we go to step three. And step three is, thou fool, is the way it's translated. But that's not nearly strong enough. That's saying, oh, you villain, you perfectly rotten, no good so-and-so, you did that willfully, you scoundrel. Now, there's a progression in those three. The first thing is, I'm angry. Now, it says, whoso is angry with his brother, he's in danger of the judgment. Okay, suppose the court hears the case, and I explain, he did thus and so, and I was furious with him. Okay, but the court says, okay, we've heard from you now. Now let's hear from the other fellow. And he says, yes, I know, I did that. And I remember his first response was, oh, blazes, how can you possibly have done exactly what I told you? So the court hears the case, and he says to me, you're furious with him, eh? Well, I think we better lock you up for a few days and let you cool off. But then we get to the second step, and that is, saying, you fool, you stupid idiot, you moron. What am I really saying there is, oh, look how much smarter I am than you are. Now the court hears this case and says, well, the trouble with some smart guys is they didn't smart in the right place. And so I've heard now from both sides of you, and it's quite clear that you went way overboard, and you have done damage to his reputation, 3 years in prison. That's the appellate court. But now we go to the Sanhedrin, or the Supreme Court, with the last one, when I'm saying, you are a villain. You are a willful sinner. If my brother is a willful sinner, continues to practice it, that's what I'm saying. I'm really saying he is worthy of second death, am I not? And if so, I am in danger of the Gehenna of fire. I am in danger of the same second death that I am assigning to him. Judge not that ye be not judged, is the Lord's advice to each of us. As time goes along, the more stress in the world, remember, our tempers tend to grow shorter. We have the more need for this part of the Sermon on the Mount. Verses 27 through 32. Ye have heard that it was said, thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you that everyone that looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. And if thy right eye causeth thee to stumble, pluck it out and cast it from thee, for it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not the whole body be cast into Gehenna. And if thy right hand causeth thee to stumble, cut it off and cast it from thee, for it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not thy whole body go into Gehenna. It was said also, whosoever shall put away his wife, let him give her a writing of divorcement. But I say unto you that everyone that putteth away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, maketh her an adulteress, and whosoever shall marry her when she is put away, committeth adultery. Now, if we recall from Deuteronomy, that it allowed certain things in connection with divorce and remarriage, and it also prescribed the penalties for it. As we read these verses, we probably tend to think verses 27 and 28 are one lesson, verses 31 and 32 are another lesson. But verses 29 and 30 connect the two. If thy right eye causeth thee to stumble, pluck it out and cast it from thee, for it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not thine whole body be cast into Gehenna. Now, if you got cancer of the right eye, would you want to get that eye removed, or would you like to wait till the whole body dies? There are some people who have had that choice to make. And for most people, the choice was pretty obvious. And similarly, if it's the hand, I had a coworker for whom it was his leg, and he says, yes, this is exactly what it means in the literal sense. Now, in verses 27 and 8, it's talking about lusting with the eye. And so verse 29 says, if thy right eye causeth thee to stumble. But then verse 30, if thy right hand, okay, now we're doing something about it. The one is the thinking, the other is the doing. And the next two verses, verses 31 and 2, are telling us, okay, so the law permitted a divorce. But if you're just looking for a way to get around making an adultery, you've already been guilty of it in your heart. So, the lesson is, don't think about it and don't try to get around it. You can't stop the birds from flying overhead, but you can sure keep them from nesting in your hair. I'm sure as we go along through the rest of the harvest, life in this world isn't going to be getting better. It's going to be the other way around. There's more fornication in the world. There's more adultery in the world. There's almost certain to be more of it among us as that happens. We are not of the world, but the fact is we are in it. And where do we come from? We come from our environment. We are influenced by our environment, but we are not to be controlled by it. The law permitted divorce and remarriage. But if the second spouse divorced the wife, or the husband for that matter, that spouse could not return to the first spouse because that would be an abomination in Israel. So there was the permission given for divorce and remarriage, and there were the penalties attached as well. Jesus, here and in other places, considerably expands the description of what qualifies as adultery. But it's interesting to note, Jesus prescribes no penalty for it. So if it happens, should we prescribe a penalty for it? Or is the goal the recovery of the sinning individual? I think it was last Thanksgiving, a brother offered a thoughtful question. The publicans and the harlots that came gladly to hear Jesus, would they be turned off by his followers today? Sobering. One more thing we'll take time for then. Verses 33 to 37. Again ye have heard that it was said to them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shall perform unto the Lord thine oaths. But I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by the heaven, for it is the throne of God, nor by the earth, for it is the footstool of his feet, nor by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Neither shalt thou swear by thy head, for thou canst not make one hair white or black. I'm discovering that these days. But let your speech be, yes means yes, and no means no. And whatsoever is more than these is of the evil one. That's the essence of it for us. We are to tell the truth and only the truth. They ask you in court to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So let your yes mean yes and your no mean no, because everything else is what comes from the evil one, Satan. And I have one more topic to address, and that is punctuality.